Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Dan Folt, and I am here, I suppose, as the attorney with the pool, as a client, to present my appeal on the issue of disqualification. The first issue raised in this appeal, perhaps a novel one, concerns whether the trial court applied the correct legal standard for disqualification.
Is it basically a declaratory judgment you're looking for now? Because if we reverse, the case is over, isn't it? It's settled. It's moot.
Functionally, I suppose that may be correct, yes. I guess if the court thinks I was improperly disqualified and issues a decision, obviously I and my firm think that's important because, as we argued in our papers, there's a certain, the way that this particular disqualification was handed down publicly has pejorative aspects. And if the disqualification was not appropriately entered, having an order to that effect cures that. I think that's why in info technology, this court granted standing to attorneys. And it's unusual, frankly, to see that because when this first came about, and I had forgotten about info technology, it goes back, I think, to 1992, and I was looking in the law. Many, many states simply do not provide an attorney standing to make this type of appeal. There's a big
division.
Well,
let's go back to the idea of mootness or a case in controversy. As I understand your response to Justice Ridgely, it's your position that this is not moot because it may have collateral consequences for you professionally.
For me professionally, and I would also argue, I hope objectively, that I think it has consequences that go beyond me, that go to the bench, if our arguments are accepted by the court.
Well, but that's the precedential value. We need to come up with a case in controversy. So as I understand it, in order to avoid mootness, because the case is over, we're really talking about the consequences, collateral consequences for you professionally. Then we can get into whatever precedent we're going to have evolved from the case once we have a case to decide.
I understand that, Justice Hall, and I guess what I'm thinking, and perhaps I'm wrong, is there is a doctrine relating to mootness and standing that's come up in constitutional areas where continuing harm evading review is what I mean to refer to. One could argue that this would fall into the qualification under that standard because there's this type of thing may continue and evade review, and that could be an exception to the doctrine.
Well, I'm familiar with that, but you only get to that doctrine when the case is moot. So my question for you is, are you submitting to us today it's not moot, or it is moot, but we should invoke the exception?
I'm submitting that it is not moot. But in the event that I'm wrong, I hope that the court would consider the exception, because I think that if I'm wrong, that may apply. If the
And now this exception, which has a label, it's the public interest exception, allows us to review issues which are capable of repetition yet evading review. Isn't this pretty fact intensive?
I think I'd have to answer that no, but I understand that there could well be reasonable differences of opinion. I mean, our principal argument here is that the legal standard wasn't applied, and that could be viewed as a legal question. If the court thinks that that's not the best issue and the court determines this really is something where we have to go by the standard and look at all of the conduct involved, then I would be mistaken. But the way we wrote the appeal, the way I presented the appeal, I thought I was presenting two questions and that the court could, if it chose to, answer those questions without going into the kind of who shot John nuts and bolts of the case.
Well, as I understand your argument in that regard, you're saying that in the future it would be helpful for everyone to know that before you disqualify an attorney, you have to give the attorney notice that that may be coming and give them a reasonable opportunity to be heard and respond. That you just simply can't disqualify an attorney sua sponte and not even give a reason. Is that what you're saying would be helpful to clear up for the future?
Yes.
My problem is if it's fact-intensive, assuming that that's the case, it's hard for me to tell from the record what the facts are, because the trial judge thought it was inappropriate to describe the facts. That makes it difficult for a review on appeal.
Absolutely, I understand that. I think that creates two challenges for my appeal. I think, and I'll answer that in two parts. First, I think one of the problems, I would argue that that's part of the problem with the way that the trial court decided this case. There are cases, and we cited them in our paper, that vague and cursory allegations can't support a disqualification. I think the reason that's a rule is because then you have an appellate court, if it chooses to accept an appeal like this, with its hands up in its air, wondering what actually happened to merit that particular extreme remedy. I think if you look at the opposition paper, you see that problem in action. The opposition is present to defend the action of the trial court, but the opposition didn't know what to defend, so it just kind of tried to cover anything it could, I think, none of which was discussed by the trial court. So the temptation, taking me to the second part of my answer, would be to consider whether this is something that ought to be remanded with perhaps instructions and a standard. And that would be an understandable outcome, though perhaps not best for me and my firm, because that continues this and goes on. All I can say on that is, we gave the trial judge, I think the trial judge had three opportunities to explain the decision. There was an opportunity in the summary judgment decision. The part concerning me is the last two sentences of a 33-page opinion. We filed a motion for re-argument. We got a very short, indefinite response back. We filed for an interlocutory appeal, and the court had a chance at those times. I think the court declined its chance to answer, and perhaps the court had good reason. I don't know what the court's reasons are, so it's useless for me to speculate why it didn't do it. I don't believe personally, and I know those that have worked with me in this case have not been able to find what could possibly have justified the disqualification in this case. I think if this court has the entire record before it that the judge had, I think it's important to note that in this case, the judge basically saw counsel twice, once in 2006 and a year later in the summer of 2007. In 2006, there was a routine discovery motion. We presented our disqualification motions, and the judge didn't set an oral argument. He wouldn't take oral argument on those motions, and he wouldn't decide them. He was just going to dismiss them without prejudice, and there was no further discussion. Had those motions somehow been so poorly put together in the papers that they merited the extreme sanction of a disqualification, it seems to me in Delaware the court would have said something then. A year later, we end up in front of the court. The transcript is before this court in the record. It was a very civil and professional summary judgment hearing. The issues were discussed thoughtfully. There was, I've had hearings that have been heated. This was the opposite of that.
Well, the judge referred primarily to briefing, where there was intense, palpable animosity.
And that's what we focused on, because we were pretty certain it didn't have anything to do with oral argument or deposition. So we looked at the papers. They're all in the record. There were a couple motions in limine. There was a summary judgment paper. They're all very benign. I've certainly written more zealous papers than that. And there was the same motions, unchanged from 2006, that had been resubmitted. And they didn't merit that sanction before. We don't think they should merit a sanction ever, but that's what happened. And he didn't answer. And just to come back for a second to Chief Justice Steele's question, I know that the trial court felt, and I think in good conscience, I've been in front of this judge several times before, always very positive experience. This experience floored me here. And I know this is a very conscientious and outstanding judge. And when that trial court says that they don't want to elaborate because they think that it compounds the error, I think that that's what that judge believes, honestly. But I disagree, because I think it did compound the error in a case and a state where civility and professionalism are major hallmarks of our practice, for which we are recognized as a bench and bar outside of Delaware. These are pretty serious issues. And in our state, we have had occasions where trial counsel have exceeded the bounds of acceptable behavior. This court doesn't need me to remind it of those cases. I cited some in our papers. There were some horrific incidences of conduct before. And when that's come up in front of many good trial judges, those trial judges have identified specifically that conduct. By not identifying the conduct here.
Well, it is hard to tell from the opinion what the trial judge was referring to, but he did refer to the briefs, and they are in the appendices, and there's at least one example that I'd like you to comment on, and that's in Defendant State Farm and Casualty Company's motion for summary judgment. The brief is February 1, 2007, and footnote 10, and there's this reference: notwithstanding the obvious conflict created by the facts of this case, Mr. Woods continues to press forward as plaintiff's counsel, hoping to share in a monetary recovery for the harm Mr. Woods at best contributed to, and more likely is largely responsible for. Isn't that more than just stating an issue of causation? Isn't it also impugning Mr. Woods' integrity?
I would disagree, Your Honor, and suffer whatever consequences come from that statement, if I may explain. Civility and zealous advocacy are reconcilable. Some might think that there's a balance. But you can be an aggressive advocate, a zealous advocate, not an overzealous, not an overaggressive advocate. If you abide by simple things, you watch your tone, your expressions, you don't use profanity, insulting analogies, all these things that have been the subject of our cases. But what happens when you have a case like this one, in which there's a lot of conduct we talk about in this brief, and it looks so extreme, does professionalism and civility curb you from stating directly what you believe to be a factor? Now, with reference to that specific comment, what are the components of that comment? The components of that comment first are, Mr. Woods had the opportunity to prevent this entire case and episode from occurring simply by issuing a medical release. That's standard in the practice. The witnesses who were deposed all testified the refusal had never been happened before. The basis for his refusal, the line of cases, is not supported by the line of cases. And when we asked him about this in his deposition, why didn't you simply either issue a release or provide the medical reports? His answer was that he was going to invoke work product. Previous to that time, he had given different answers. He said he didn't give a release because it was unnecessary. He didn't give the medical records because it was too expensive. Obviously, State Farm had offered to pay for the records and get them through the release. The trial judge, despite everything else, noted in denying summary judgment both ways that the discovery had illuminated these issues, and there were core issues as to why Mr. Woods had done some of the things that he had done in the case and whether that had contributed to causation. And that was part of the equation. The other part concerning financial motives is we're very protective of attorneys in this bar, and I've seen that firsthand. I understand that, and as an attorney, appreciate that level of courtesy and respect we give one another. But when we become a fact witness, are we as attorneys who go from being advocates to witnesses subject from the right of impeachment than any other witness is? Any other witness we could write about and say that they had a financial incentive. In this case, the evidence suggested at that time that the contingent fee that Mr. Woods could have received in this case would have exceeded a year's salary. Now, if that had been anyone other than an attorney, that would have been considered, I think, legitimate impeachment for financial bias. In this case, had Mr. Woods withdrawn, as both predecessor and successor judge recommended but did not order him to do, someone else would have come in, and that would have changed the financial arrangements. So there was a fair question, one that I thought we would have been allowed to have put to the jury, whether those were the factors. One of the big problems in this case, I hope the Supreme Court will think about, if they share the view of its importance that I hold, is the witness advocate rule. I mean, a lot of these problems resulted because the witness advocate rule, as construed by the ABA, and this court, I believe, is supportive of that view, is that you don't wait to the eve of trial and the courthouse steps to step away when you're a witness advocate because these type of problems occur. That's what happened here. So is that a direct statement? Yes, it is. And does it impugn his integrity? I think the question there turns upon, and maybe I have the wrong side of this, and if I do, I'll be accountable, is there is a distinction between impeaching someone as a fact witness and impeaching someone as counsel. It may be a gray area in this case because the overlap was so close. But I believe that statement was a direct and candid reflection of that argument, and I think it was a fair statement. And if I'm wrong, I'm sure the court will let me know.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I did. Appreciate that.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely. I'd like to touch on the first issue that was raised. I believe this is moot. I responded because I thought that someone should respond and give the court the full record, because in Mr. Folt's opening brief, there was next to nothing about, you know, exactly what had gone on, what papers were filed, what was said. So I submitted them, but I believe it is a moot issue. The Dunlaps and State Farm have settled. The case is done. I also believe, if the court thinks it's not a moot issue, I believe a remand is a waste of judicial resources. I think you have enough in the record that you can make your own judgment as to whether Judge Herlihy was within his discretion in what he did. I think he was. In 27 years of practice, I have never been treated by another lawyer the way I was treated in this case.
You were eventually disqualified in this case, weren't you?
Yes, I disagree with Judge Hurley's decision on that, but we did not appeal from that. That's correct.
And the record seems to reflect that you and Judge Abelman had an ex parte conversation that led her to recuse herself.
I have copies of the notes that I wrote when I got back to my office that day, and I'd be willing to share them with the court if you'd like.
Well, no, this is a question.
Okay. Yes.
Isn't it a fact that Judge Abelman said, Mr. Woods and I had an ex parte conversation, and I'm entering my disqualification?
That's what she said in her first one-line letter. And then she wrote another letter saying that she was recusing herself because she couldn't hear it free from bias, which, in my personal opinion, I think is closer to the truth.
And ultimately, the record reflects that you probably were going to be a witness. And under our decision in Waters, you can't be an advocate and a witness in the same case.
Justice Holland, I still disagree with Judge Hurley's ruling. I do not think that there was anything that I needed to testify about, because everything of consequence was in writing. It's either reflected in letters or it's reflected in State Farm's file.
The judges ruled that.
He did rule that, yes.
You were deposed.
Yes.
So at least somebody thought during the course of discovery you may have fact evidence to present.
That's correct.
And you agree that if reasonable minds could differ and you did have factual matter to present, you couldn't continue as an advocate.
That's true. And I had backup counsel lined up.
So what do you understand? Were you surprised when the opinion came out? I understand you disagree with your disqualification, but did you anticipate that Mr. Folt would be disqualified also?
I did not, and I did not move for that.
So Mr. Folt's legal argument is that issue was not before the court. There was no motion pending. No rule to show cause had been entered to him to show why you shouldn't be disqualified, and that he was more than surprised when he got the opinion in response to his motion to disqualify you that said, Mr. Woods is disqualified, and while I'm at it, by the way, Mr. Folt is disqualified. So you're here, and we appreciate you trying to be helpful to the court in presenting the record and giving us an adversarial presentation. So what's your understanding of the basis for Judge Herlihy's ruling?
I'll follow up on something Justice Ridgely said. We don't really know because he didn't specify his reasons. I could guess, and I think that it starts with the July 1986 motion hearing in which Judge Herlihy stopped me and said that he detected personal animus between counsel. I think that he would have been reasonable reading the briefs to conclude that that had continued. And then at the summary judgment hearing in June of 2007, Mr. Fold again accused me of professional negligence, and it's not in the record, but Judge Herlihy lowered his head and grimaced at that point. That's all I can tell you. I believe that if you've read my, and I apologize for the lengthy appendix, and I'm sure you have, I think that there is more than adequate cause, and I think that this is not a situation where it came completely out of the blue, because over a year earlier in July of 06, Judge Herlihy, he had let us know, hey guys, I don't like where this is going, and it continued.
Let me ask if there's any policy analogy, I'll call it for lack of a better thought, between a situation where the trial judge disqualifies counsel and when the trial judge observes conduct that the trial judge believes is contempt that occurs in the presence of the judge. Now, I ask that for two reasons. In the background, trial judges have full authority, inherent authority, to control the conduct in the court and outside the court of counsel. In contempt situations, if it occurs in the presence of the judge, we don't require notice in a hearing, but we do require that the judge put on the record the judge's rationale, the facts that the judge believes constituted the contempt, and then the analysis from the law of contempt about why those facts justify a form of sanction and why one sanction as opposed to another.
Right.
Yeah. Is there an analogy to be drawn here? If the judge believes that conduct that constitutes a basis for disqualification is already a matter of record in briefs or papers, including deposition transcripts, or occurs in the courtroom in his presence, is there a need to give notice to counsel and a right to be heard? But secondarily, if the judge is going to opt for that course of action, should we set a standard where the judge must spell out, no matter how onerous it may be to that judge or how impalpable that may be to the judge, exactly why the judge reached the conclusion that one or more lawyers should be disqualified? Because for the purposes of review, if review is appropriate, put the mootness issue aside, I'm at a loss to understand how a judge did or didn't abuse his or her discretion when I don't know the factual basis for the exercise of that discretion. Now, that's a very unfair diatribe posing as a question, but please do the best you can with it.
As I understand, the first question is there an analogy to be drawn to the contempt situation that occurs in the presence of the court in this situation? And I think yes. I think trial judges do have inherent authority. One of the things that does not come through in transcript is tone. And I think there were instances. I don't know whether Judge Herlihy read all the deposition transcripts or just the portions that were submitted to them. But there were two occasions in which I had to caution Mr. Fold against this tone, one in my deposition, one in another deposition. Whether he read that or not, it's certainly preferable to answer your second question, Chief Justice Steele, if I can. It is preferable for the judge to spell out reasons, and perhaps your ruling might be along the lines of, in the future, no matter how onerous it is to you, we would like to see the reasons. But I do think that there's enough in this record that you could rule without wasting judicial resources with a remand and then possibly another appeal.
But that requires us to guess, doesn't it, what he relied upon? You've referred to a smorgasbord of possible incidents, but we don't know which of those he chose and which of those, some of them may be stronger than others.
How are we to decide the appeal?
Perhaps there's an analogy to be drawn to the concept of harmless error, that the court could say, well, this is what we think would have justified it. Whether that was what Judge Hurley was thinking or not, we don't know because he hasn't told us, and in the future we want trial judges to tell us, but this is what we found in the record that bothers us.
But going back to the Chief Justice's analogy, you could see if at the summary judgment proceeding, when there was also possibly argument on the motion to disqualify you, the judge could say, look, I've read the discovery as part of the summary judgment proceeding, and I've read this motion for disqualification. I've seen the two of you interacting here today, and I just want you to know you're both out of the case. So everybody walks out of the case. But here, what we have is different because the judge has basically not acted based on what's in his presence, or at least given anyone notice that he's so unhappy with what has occurred in his presence that he's considering disqualifying both attorneys. And then you get an opinion, which you admit surprised you when Fult was disqualified.
That's true. And I'm sorry, did I miss your question?
So my question is, when we're talking about what the procedure should be in the future, if we're using the contempt analogy, it would say that to the extent you have a concern about something that's conducted in your presence, you either act while the lawyers are still in your presence, give them notice of the concern about what happened in your presence, and they address it. But if to the extent you're going to be looking at a record and make a decision based on your review of a factual record, the better practice would be to give the people notice and an opportunity to be heard. And so having, you know, characterized those two choices, how do we apply it in this case? One thing would be to hold that here are the choices in the future, but to the extent either of those choices is available in the future, what happened here and doesn't conform to either one. So the disqualification should not have occurred. Or we say it should have, but you know, you tell us how you would argue upholding the disqualification.
I think setting forth a standard to be applied in the future, but also making your own determination based on what you've seen in the record is appropriate in this case. Justice Holland, if I may get back to the ex parte conference. That, as you can imagine, particularly bothers me. I've looked at the rule. The rule says it's not an ex parte communication if it's by court order. I did some research. I didn't find any cases on whether court permission counts as a court order, but I did ask the judge, may I speak to you privately? And it would really do me a lot of good if you would be so kind as to look at the notes that I wrote. But I understand if you don't want to look at them, that's your call. But I particularly...
Now, we've read the record, and we understand that the initial trial judge and Mr. Fult thought the Delaware Supreme Court decided the case incorrectly. And the conference with the judge led you to believe that the strength of the trial judge's disagreement with the Supreme Court gave you some concern with regard to moving forward impartially and might have prompted you to initiate a conversation which you didn't intend to lead to a recusal, but ultimately moved in that direction. So we understand the concerns and how it evolved and what the result was.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to, if I may, start with, go back to what Justice Ridgely pointed out, and you gave me one example or anecdote from the briefing, and there may be others that have concerned you and we don't have time for today. And we talked about that, but what I would say even if the court's opinion, which is controlling, not mine, is right, and my view is mistaken, and I'll soon be corrected, that wouldn't be a basis for disqualification, you know, an overzealous statement. There's never been a case like that in Delaware before. If you look at cases like Abbott and Crawhorn, where people were screaming profanities at one another, making physical threats, using grotesque animal analogies and all sorts of things, counsel in those cases were appropriately sanctioned and publicly reprimanded, and yet they still weren't disqualified. I think Mumford's the only case in which the conduct was so grotesque that a disqualification was upheld. And in deciding, I mean, I think disqualification is a remedy of last resort. There's a lot of cases that say it's discouraged. There were also judges, I think trial judges, and all three of the members of the bench, I believe, were trial judges, so I'm not telling the court anything it doesn't already know. But
I wasn't. I just practiced periodically.
Okay. I stand corrected. You were on the Supreme Court, I think, when I came to Delaware. So I
on the job training.
Had a doubt there. Thank you for correcting me. But the I think judges, trial or otherwise, know that where there are less draconian remedies available, you can do them. In this case, Mr. Woods had been disqualified on the non-pejorative basis that he was a witness, so there wasn't going to be the possibility suggested in the judge's second decision that there might be some problem at trial. He wasn't going to be an advocate at trial. All that left is the instance in which he would be cross-examined by me, and trial judges know, and this happens all the time, that there are less draconian ways to cure that. You can have a conference, you can limit the scope and order of the examination before the examination or during sidebar. So it seems to me that even if that one comment was determined to be different than we had done it, there certainly isn't any precedent for that happening. A few last quick points with my time. My view of tones and grimaces is different. I have a different recollection from Mr. Woods. I won't belabor that point. But the time that the judge interrupted and made that comment about conduct, that was in response to comments Mr. Woods was making, who was speaking at that time. This court has, I think it's the Abbott decision, but I might be wrong, but I read it with great interest, identified a number of words and phrases in briefing in which this court said are just absolutely inappropriate. I think every lawyer in the bar read it because people had used some of those, perhaps too casually, and I doubt they will anymore. One of those words is ridiculous, and one of those words appears in the answering brief. And so, again, it's hard when you're going to disqualify somebody to look at a single word, because I think in Abbott the issue was context, and there were a lot of words, and there were certainly some horrible examples in that case not present here. Ultimately, with 50 seconds left, I asked the court, what's the lesson? Because if I'm to be taught a lesson, I'm willing to accept responsibility for my conduct. But what I see and my firm saw is there was an ex parte meeting. Perhaps the court sees this differently, but as I've read the rule and researched the cases, if I wanted to recuse a judge, I would file a motion. I wouldn't ask to see the judge privately. If you file a motion, however, there's the chance it'll be denied. I don't need to bring to attention to this court those cases and those judges in the Superior Court where this has happened and gained much newspaper attention in the not-too-distant past. People have filed motions to disqualify judges. The disqualification has been denied. But by meeting someone privately and having a conversation, and I don't know what happened in that conversation, we asked and were never told what, why, or how. Your Honor, I see my time is out. Unless the court will permit me to finish, I am done.
Finish that thought.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Just 1 second. I saw the timer now. Lost it. My concern is that it appeared to be an ex parte meeting, and yet maybe everyone but us is satisfied that it wasn't. Nobody reported it, not predecessor, successor. No one reported it. There were no consequences, and yet I was disqualified for what the trial judge described as mutual conduct that had a pejorative cast to it, and the opponent was not, even though there was mutuality. That's difficult to reconcile, particularly when disqualification is a last resort. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.